Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Well, good morning, Mo.
Morning.
I'm here in the office at the University of Minnesota, and of course, as always, I have, there you go. I've already had one. This is number two. In general, I need three cups, but just before we get started with the topic that I would like to discuss with you today, yeah. I want to point out, I'm going to angle the screen down.
Oh, look at that.
We've had this debate about attire and professionalism. There's a phenomenon of for older surgeons such as myself, where you have holiday ties, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
yes.
I think I have 22, and I don't nearly be, thanks to the pandemic, I don't have near the opportunities to wear them. So I'm taking this opportunity to abuse the anybody that's viewing this for one of my favorites, which is the Looney Tunes. You're probably too young to know about Looney Tunes cartoons.
Oh my gosh, I grew up on them. I love them.
Oh, okay. So yeah, this is Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
It's the Taz.
Oh yeah, Tasmanian Devil, of course.
Yeah. I mean, it's all good. Daffy Duck. I mean, we got right. The whole thing. So
that's awesome.
It's probably unprofessional attire, but you know,
I think it's hip. I think it's very hip. I like it.
Yeah, but would we? Be better as if, you know, this is the old style, really thick tie. I need a skinny holiday tie to get close to your sense of fashion in your generation. But well, with that necessary conversation out of the way, what I'd like to talk about is a manuscript we just published November 16th. Edition of Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, and it is about position factors as it relates to arthroplasty outcomes. And this is, I think, a very important article. And from when our preliminary discussions, I think you agree.
Right.
But the impact of surgeon variability on patient-reported outcome measures, length of stay, discharge disposition, and 90-day readmission in total knee. This is from the Cleveland Clinic. And they looked at a large data set, 5,429 patients between 2016 and 2018, with some various patient reported outcome measures, the COOS and others. And they carefully looked at minimally clinically important differences. And they looked at the impact of the surgeons on these patient reported outcomes. And they also looked at other patient-related outcomes, such as BMI, Charlson Comorbidity Index, et cetera, looking at the impact of these factors, both patient factors and physician factors, on the patient-reported outcomes. And they conclude, in a very statistically sound done project, that surgeon-related factors may be stronger contributors to the one-year patient-reported outcome measures and length of stay than patient characteristics, which have been traditionally emphasized in the literature. So I think this is a very important paper. And just what are your thoughts on this whole issue of surgeon factors?
Sure. I mean, Mark, I mean, how many times have I sat in rounds or at a journal club where surgeons would dismiss, you know, some of our surgeons when I was a resident, for sure, would dismiss a paper because they're saying, that's just not, I don't get those results. I mean, if you do this procedure correctly or whatever, you know, and there'd be all these data, and everyone kind of roll their eyes and say, well, you know, fair enough, right? You can say that, but there's always been this internal belief that surgeon variability is an important factor. And this gets back to, I think, you know, another really critically important issue around the whole issue of randomized trials. So because randomized trials have always been, you know, believed to be, well, if you do a randomized trial and you in this case, adjust by center, meaning that, you know, like that we adjust for a center having, you know, an equal number of A's and B's getting put in, that does not get around the risk of having one surgeon who may be the, you know, having better outcomes getting all of the A's and one surgeon or group of surgeons who may not have the same outcomes getting all the B's, which could lead to this exact problem. So it does lead to a lot of issues and puts in question, as I think we've thought about in the past too, with some of our other trials, how do you handle this? With this realization? Because I think we've always believed it, but we've always thought, well, you know, our analyses can adjust for it. The truth is, I don't think our analyses can necessarily correct for a major imbalance. And we have to be thinking of strategies in the way we think of trials, and not just for the more complicated procedures. Mark, I would say that some of the more, you know, fundamental, like this is for total knee replacement, you said? I mean, that's, you know, that's a fairly standard procedure, but still going to have, you know, a range of variability here. So this is where I think we have a lot of opportunity and discussion. Now, before I jump to what I think the solution could be, which I think is the expertise-based trial, which we've talked about a bit, that may not still be the answer. But I'm curious from your perspective, when you read this, what is it about this that gave you pause?
Well, that just it is so clearly a major factor in patient-reported outcomes. Because when of all the types of interventions that we study in orthopedics, I mean, you know, total knee replacement is at the top of the list as far as the how common it is and the huge numbers, you know, 700,000-900,000 per year.
Right.
Maybe even a million a year in the States. And there are not that many surgeons who are doing it. So they're it's pretty much a high volume procedure, especially at a place like the Cleveland Clinic, where it's a major referral center, people being referred for arthroplasty in from perhaps all around the country. So it was just to see that there was that much influence of the individual surgeon was a bit shocking. Quite frankly, I've been less surprised in trauma trials because, you know, the surgeon is so critical in terms of reduction of fracture, whether it's closed or open. And we know that there's variability in the surgeon ability to get a good reduction. And we've seen this with the hip trials of you know, malreduction of fracture when we're trying to isolate the impact of an implant. The implant is put at an unfair stress when the fracture is not reduced. So like cutout and things like that. So what surprised me was the magnitude of effect for perhaps the most common major procedure in lower extremity surgery. That's what surprised me.
And so the question is, what do you do about it? I mean, so, okay, so now we have this whole database of trials. And let's just say that we take this study at face value. I mean, obviously it'll be repeated, we hope, and there'll be others looking at the same data. But let's just say this is an absolute truth that in fact, you know, that they've defined some measure of variability, that variability exists, and there's a magnitude that we can quantify. If you look now at every prior trial, and I know that this wasn't a trial per se, there was an observational study, but now we apply this to trials where they've looked at A versus B, you know, some a total hip replacement or a total knee replacement where they've looked at liner A versus B, some implant A versus implant B. You know, how do you make sense of all that now, knowing that even if we adjusted for center, we've missed out on that fundamental issue, which is within a center, there's a lot of variability, and it and the randomization could have quite reasonably led to you know, big differences between, you know, which surgeons got which patients, and one surgeon could very easily, in a when you're randomizing across 6-7 surgeons, one surgeon could very easily be the one who gets, he or she could get 5 A's in a row just because of the way it works out with the patients getting relegated. So it's not unreasonable to think, you know, that that we could have these imbalances all over the place, which kind of puts a bit of a challenge into how we think about studies. So do studies now have to, should we be asking, you know, for some general idea of, we'll say not necessarily qualifications, but expertise? We talked about the expertise trial like we did in the health trial. Some measure of expertise? Should we be, you know, thinking about surgeon now being a factor in, you know, adjustment right up front, like, you know, collecting by individual rather than by center? You know, those kind of things add a pretty significant amount of complexity into how we think about how we're going to move this forward.
Right. And you may be aware, but I am not of any trial where there has been an adjustment for the surgeon, the individual surgeon. Have you seen that before?
No. So way back when, in the days of the Sprint trial, we had some discussion around the individual surgeon, because remember, there was a huge crossover rate between the non-ream to the ream. But the reality was that 1 in 4 surgeons in the Sprint trial for the ream to non-ream tibial nailing study hadn't actually performed an unream nail. So they were being told for the first time, I'm going to do an unream nail. And there was a lot of crossover from unream to ream. So we evaluated that. We didn't have enough surgeons doing enough cases that Steve Walter, who was the senior statistician at that time, was able to determine that there was, a bias that was based on differential expertise. But I can tell you that for sure exists, right? This idea of a differential expertise bias is really the risk that we're trying to mitigate.
Right.
And that gets back to then, what do you do, right? So in this particular case, the solution that PJ Devereaux and others at McMaster had suggested, and we attempted really to apply that broadly in the health trial or hip fracture trial of total versus hemiarthroplasty, was rather than randomizing patients, rather than surgeon, getting patient A or patient B, it was a patient is randomized to a surgeon with expertise in the specific technique that they're going to be allocated to. In that mindset, you would have to then have some measure to say, well, what is that threshold for expertise? And this gets into a whole bunch of stuff. Like this paper, in many ways, if we take it as, truth, has a huge implication on the way we think of trials and organizing research going forward. This is not a non-complex issue to deal with now.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, there's a huge difference between elective surgical trials, which this is not a trial. Again, we should be clear.
Yeah, right.
It's not a trial. It's an observational cohort analysis.
Yeah.
But between elective and traumatic surgery, where it's totally different. And I would really like to point out, too, that it may not be that these differences at 1 year in patient-reported outcomes is solely related to how the implant is put in. As a matter of fact, I would venture to guess it may be just as important in patient selection, how the patient is instructed before and after about what to expect, the rehabilitation protocols, and how the individual patient is compliant with them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think those are more likely than not, those non-surgical factors are more important than actually how the implant is put in, because at a place like this, the variability in the alignment of the tibial cut is not going to be great for sure in an experience center like this. So it is issues around patient communication and pre and post-op information and how those patient characteristics interact with those instructions.
Now, let me ask you this, Mark, from a broader perspective of, let's just say, there's so much interest right now in, patients choosing their surgeons. I mean, this kind of information, is particularly important, or can be particularly important for, sort of the implications around, at a broader level. And I'd imagine in USA more so than Canada, but I'm sure it happens everywhere, which is patient, finds out, well, I want to know if your outcomes are comparable to someone else's outcome. If I'm told that this has a huge implication, there will be an open demand for that. And the question is, what does that look like? And what sort of information and data are individual surgeons going to be required to provide? If in fact, again, I mean, this goes down a whole pathway of validation of this work, but let's just say, right, this opens up a lot of different, issues. The reality is, the reality is that up until now, it's always been like, everyone just says, look, listen, you come to me, you've come to the right place.
Yeah.
Here's how I do it very well.
Yeah.
But now when when there's research that says, no, it definitely has impact, right? Because, there's volume outcomes research that's been done in the past that talks about, but this is So this is getting to a very specific issue around surgeon matters.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Everyone believes that, right? But patients now, you know, have choices.
Right. Well, there's a large number of centers in the joint replacement realm that are, you know, collecting routinely patient-reported outcome measures as well as clinical measures pre, post-op, and trying to get follow-up out to a year, and then looking at individual surgeon results as they relate. And I think that should be public information, personally.
Yeah.
Patients as they become more literate with what patient-reported outcome measures can do and their limitations as well, it's going to have a broad spread interest across the board in having this information be public. I don't have a problem with that because, you know, we started out the conversation. You mentioned the conference where you're talking about a paper and then the professor gets up and say, well, this doesn't apply to me. I don't have these results. When reality, all they're talking about is the last two cases they can remember. You know, they don't have a systematic follow-up of the patients that they think they do or would like to think they do. And that's just not right. When I go around talking about the impact of the surgeon, I often use the acetabular fracture fixation. And I know you did work with Joel Mata, but
right. It
is really unfair or incorrect, rather, not as well as unfair, to quote a patient the results from Joel Mata's massive series as it relates to that individual patient when you've got a surgeon who's done 50 acetabular fracture surgeries. That results from that surgeon are not going to be Joel Mata's results. And that individual surgeon has the responsibility of assessing their own outcomes in terms of, you know, conversion to hip replacement or infection or return to the OR or whatever. And we're just not doing that in any systematic way. And I think we, in the future, we're going to have to find better ways to give patients the information as to what individual surgeon outcomes are, in fact.
And I'd argue it happens in almost every area, right? I mean,
yeah. You
know, we publish a meta-analysis, we publish a trial, and that becomes the focus for giving prognostic information to patients. With this procedure, based on this research, you are likely to have this outcome.
Correct.
Larger studies, though, I guess Mark would argue that, okay, they're probably going to be a mix of all the, you know, sort of the variability among surgeon expertise that would be built into that overall estimate. But you're right, you can't have single surgeon series like a Joel Mata series, for example, and say, well, my results would apply to his, unless you, for some reason, have a similar number of cases, or there is a well-defined learning curve threshold that you are, you know, surpassed, which these are not, again,
trivial notions.
This paper could be, I looked at this yesterday when you sent it to me. I said, yep, there's no point in me discussing anything else because we can go for another 20 minutes on this one. Because it opens up a lot more questions than even the things that we can answer. But these are important issues because I think, you know, it brings to light so many issues that we take for granted every day.
Absolutely. And it cuts to the root of how difficult surgical trials are compared to pharmacologic trials or other types of intervention where the surgeon is the method here.
Yes.
We're trying to tease out the impact of the implant, but the surgeon is 80, 90% of the result. And not only with the technical expertise, but also the pre and post-op management and discussions, et cetera. And I think we just need to be a little bit more honest about this. But I am grateful that the challenge of surgical trials is what brought Gord Guyot into your life and my life. But Gord, obviously, very successful doing cardiac trials and cancer trials, et cetera. And he accepted the challenge of educating us in the surgical world in orthopedics about how to do these trials well. And for that, I'm forever grateful. So I think this is a paper that's gonna stir some things up. And I think we're gonna see a lot of submissions focusing more on the impact of the surgeon and how we can adjust, et cetera, et cetera. So
I think you're right. That's a great paper.
Yeah. Good. Well, I'm going to go for cup number three. Thanks.
I'm just going to say, having just returned from India, I'm going chai latte now. That's what I'm doing, right? So just changing it up a bit.
Chai lattes are fantastic, particularly in the wintertime. That's great. I know. So have a great day, and thanks for the discussion, Mo. Very interesting, as always.
Right. Take care.
Cheers.